Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it's next week that your topic for the term project is due. So I need, as I said before, I need a paragraph where you explain what you intend to do. And based on that, I will decide if that's a suitable topic for a term project. So be prepared for a dialogue in case I'm not totally satisfied with your choice of topic. So that's going to be next week. And I think the second homework assignment is due next week as well. Anyway, so all of those things are announced on CourseLink, so you can find all the information. Okay, so I think that's where we were at the end of last week. So I had derived Ray Chowdhury's equation based on our description of congruences of time-like world lines. And I promised you that this was one of the most insightful equations of all of gravitational physics, and I want to, try to fulfill that promise in the course of this lecture. There are some limitations to how insightful it is in this case of time-like world lines. In the case of null geodesics, it's even more insightful. So that's something that we'll come back to at some point. So here we're basically doing the time-like case as a warm-up exercise to launch into a discussion of null geodesics. That's going to, we're going to get started on this in a few minutes. But a lot of the stuff along, for the null case parallels what we did in the time-like case is just that, well, there's more details, there's more subtleties involved. So it's going to take us, a while to get to the equivalent statement of Ray Chowdhury's equation that applies to null geodesics, but we'll get there. All right, so this is where we were. So we've defined all of those things. So we, in particular, we've defined the expansion or the rate of expansion scalar of a congruence that coincides with the four-dimensional divergence of, the U vector field. And because everything that we did in the relativistic case parallels what we did in the Newtonian case, that thing here carries exactly the same interpretation. So if we follow the motion of a tiny fluid element that's centered on one of those time-like world lines, and we compare the size and shape of that fluid element from one time to another, we're going to notice that, it typically will suffer some kind of overall scaling expansion. That's measured by the expansion here. So that's the fractional change in the volume of that fluid element. The shear tensor measures a relative change in shape. So that's a shear deformation measured by that. And the rotation tensor here measures how much rotation that fluid element undergoes as it keeps moving up in space-time like this. So basic ways of characterizing how fluid elements or, neighboring world lines behave in a congruence like this. And Ray Chowdhury's equation is really a statement about how the rate of expansion changes with time. So it's basically a double derivative. It's a second derivative. The first derivative is the fractional change in volume. And that's the rate of that changing. So if this is a sort of velocity, that's a sort of acceleration. So the interpretation of this has to be understood here because we're going to be working on that and building up on that in the next few minutes. All right, so that's the statement of Ray Chowdhury's equation, and here it's formulated in fairly general terms. So we have everything that it may have. In particular, we're allowing the world lines to be non-geodesics, and that's measured by the acceleration vector. And the last piece of this is a term involving explicitly the Ricci tensor for the space-time. And if we work in GR, we can always relate the Ricci tensor to the energy momentum tensor of the matter in the space-time. That's something that I'll do in a few minutes. All right, so that's the statement of Ray Chowdhury's equation, one of the most important equation of gravitational physics, as I promised. And what I want to do now is to turn that equation into a focusing theorem. And basically what we're going to try and do here is to establish conditions that guarantee that the right-hand side of the equation is negative, and that means that the acceleration is guaranteed to be negative. So geodesics can fly apart, so they can have a positive velocity. I'm thinking of the expansion parameter as a sort of velocity. But what we would like to be able to prove is that under reasonable conditions that we might expect to be fulfilled in the universe, that even though the velocity can be positive, the acceleration has to be negative, so that even though I'm talking about geodesics because we're going to specialize to that in a minute, even though geodesics can fly apart, the rate at which they do will decrease in time, so the relative acceleration will be negative. And that's a statement that gravity is actually pulling on those world lines and focusing them, making them expanding less fast in the future. So that's where we were, where we want to go. And we see that, well, there's some terms in equations that do come with a negative sign. So this is obviously positive, it comes with a negative sign, so that's good. This is positive, it comes with a negative time, that's good. This doesn't come with the right sign, so we're going to kill that. This we're going to have to talk about, and this doesn't come with any particular sign, so we're going to have to kill that too. So we're going to make the congruence geodesic, so that will kill the acceleration, so that's how we kill that term. And we're going to make the geodesic congruence hypersurface orthogonal, that's going to kill that. And yeah, that means that we are restricting things. We are specializing on very specific types of congruences. But we have to make those choices in order to be able to establish a theorem. All right, so here's how we go from Murray-Chaudhry's equation to a focusing theorem. And as with all theorems, there are some premises that we have to buy into. So we're going to say that the congruence is geodesic, and that guarantees that the acceleration vector is going to be zero for that congruence, and that's going to kill the last term, as I said. And we're going to be talking about a congruence that's hypersurface orthogonal. And that's a pretty severe restriction. I mean, that's certainly a weakness of the theorem in the sense that we are forced by necessity here to restrict our attention to a very specific and very specialized type of congruence, those that are hypersurface orthogonal, because we want to get rid of that omega square term in the equation. In the case of null geodesics, when we get there, we're going to see that the hypersurface orthogonality condition is less restrictive. It's still restrictive, but it's less restrictive than in this context where he seemed to be, a very strong condition to impose, but, we're going to impose it because otherwise we don't have a theorem. So that's the idea. So if we impose all of this, then the equation simplifies, and we can emphasize that, well, it's going to come with an overall minus sign that in the end will guarantee that the right-hand side is negative, and what survives those restrictions here is going to be all the positive terms that we had plus the Ricci term. And if we want a theorem, we're going to have to guarantee, in addition to the other conditions, that the Ricci term is also positive. And that's something that will require, some extra condition on the space-time. So whatever the Ricci tensor is for that space-time, we're going to have to impose that quantity here is positive. And when reinterpreted in terms of the stress tensor by imposing the field equations, we're going to see that this imposes some conditions on the type of matter that are compatible with the theorem. So that's another rather severe restriction that's going to be far less severe in the case of null geodesics when we get there. So the third condition that we're going to impose here is that I'm going to call it the Ricci condition, because fundamentally it's really a condition on the Ricci tensor. And it's that for, whatever spacetime we're dealing with and whatever vector field we're dealing with here, that component of the Ricci tensor has to be positive, or at least non-negative. So we're going to impose this, and if we have all of this, then we have a sum of positive terms, and that guarantees that the left-hand side is going to be negative, or it's going to be zero, but it can only be zero if every quantity that appears on the right-hand side is individually zero. So if we want the acceleration to be zero, we have to make sure that the velocity is zero, that the shear tensor is zero, because the square of the shear tensor can only be zero if the shear tensor by itself is zero. And same thing for here. That component of the Ricci tensor would have to be zero. So that's how we would, you know, ensure equality. But generally speaking, we would have inequality. And the interpretation of this is that if we have, you know, geodesics that fly apart, you know, with a positive expansion, then the theorem guarantees that that expansion will decrease in the future because its rate of change is negative. So if we have a situation like this, we have that, well, that's going to be true in general cases, but we're going to have that the rate of expansion will decrease, which means that, you know, even though they're flying apart now, they're going to be flying apart less rapidly in the future. And that's a statement that something is pulling on the geodesics to bring them together. And that thing, of course, is gravity. So the interpretation here is that gravity pulls the geodesics together. That's why they're not expanding as fast in the future as they were doing in the past. And that's, you know, a way of saying that gravity is an attractive force. That's probably the most meaningful way of saying that gravity, you know, as it manifests itself in the relative behavior of geodesics like this, is going to be an attractive force. It's surprisingly hard to make a statement like this, even though it sounds obvious that gravity is attractive. Turns out that there are exceptions to that statement, and it's hard to make precise, but that's a way of making it precise. And, you know, it's something that hangs on a very, very solid theorem, provided we can really guarantee that this condition is satisfied. And that's where we're going to see that there are ways of evading, you know, the theorem by just coming up with matter fields that perhaps violate the Ricci condition. So we're going to talk about that in some time. The other situation is that we may start with a situation where the geodesics are not flying apart, but they're already converging together. So that might be a different situation where, you know, the congruence is already converging like this. So that would be a situation where locally, at least, theta would be negative. And if it's starting negative and it decreases in the future, well, chances are it's going to keep on decreasing. And in fact, based on the equation, you can prove, you know, by very straightforward means, by, you know, integrating the inequality, that you're going to run into a situation where at some finite proper time in the future, theta will tend to minus infinity. So so if it started converging, it will keep on converging until you know, one or two or more geodesics come together at a point, or, you know, the topology of this can be a bit more complicated, but the point is that there's going to be a convergence of the congruence all the way to the formation of a singularity of the flow, which we call a caustic. So this is a caustic, geodesics coming together, and it's really a fancy word for describing a singularity of the flow, or a singularity of the congruences, manifested by the fact that the rate of, you know, change of the expansion, or in this case, the, you know, the rate of change of the convergence, is actually going formally to minus infinity. And we saw a situation like this in the example of circular orbits around Schwarzschild, where they were all starting from the North Pole converging to the South Pole. So at the North Pole, the expansion was formally infinite, positively, and then they all came together at the South Pole, and the expansion was formally negatively infinite. So that was a situation where geodesics were coming together in the form of a caustic. So the, you know, the topology of this here, and the, you know, what can happen in terms of, you know, the meeting of geodesics like this can be fairly complicated. There's a big, you know, part of the caustic theory that's associated with this. So they may not come necessarily together at a point. Maybe they're coming together at a line. Maybe it's a bit more complicated than this. But the point is that, you know, when before we were insisting that geodesics should be kept separate by the you know, by the nature of a well-behaved vector field. Here we have a singularity of all this. That means that, well, those conditions are breaking, and we get a singularity of the flow. Now, the singularity of the flow doesn't have to do with a singularity of space-time. So in the Schwarzschild case, there was nothing, you know, physically singular at the North Pole or the South Pole. It's just that, you know, for our chosen congruence of time-like curves that we were describing there, they just happen to meet together. So it doesn't correspond to any physical singularity. It's a singularity of the flow. But nevertheless, it means that, well, at those points, things, you know, in this description start to break down. I mean, presumably the expansion, well, the expansion for sure goes to minus infinity. Presumably the shear tensor blows up too. So everything tends to blow up at those caustic points. All right, so that's the focusing theorem. And it sounds, you know, I think very attractive, and I think it's a, you know, it's a very nice theorem, but it really hangs on those conditions that we impose. So the Judy's a condition, that's fine, can live with that. Hypersurface orthogonal, well, that's a rather severe restriction. But the Ricci condition, that's probably the one that is the weakest point of all, and that's where I think we need to spend a little bit of time thinking about it and seeing just how easy it could be to evade it if we wanted to avoid the conclusion that gravity is always attractive. So there could be situations, if the Ricci condition is violated, where you have converging word lines that eventually are repelled instead of focused by gravity, and we can conceive of situations like this. And, you know, we'll talk about that as we keep going. Questions at this stage? Yeah.
Here you are just talking in a very general way that if I have this geometry and it has this property in this congruence of geodesics or there, they can be we can have the focusing theory. Mm-hmm. That piece is going to connect us to GR, so we are going to assume Munchson's equation and then R to the matter, right?
Right.
Yeah, just I want to make sure that up to here it has nothing to do with the GR, it's very general.
Per se with GR. No, that's right. That's a very good point. Thank you for raising this. So up to now, all we were doing is basically differential geometry on a manifold. And, you know, we were sort of thinking of GR as the setting for this. But up to this point, we never said anything about the field equations. And in fact, I could stop here and say that, well, this is simply a condition on Ricci tensor, and I could avoid a connection with matter if I didn't want to bring it, because, yes, the connection with matter will involve relating the Ricci tensor to the stress energy tensor of the matter, and that means imposing the field equations. So I'm going to take this step now, but that step is not really necessary, but I think it helps to understand precisely what this means. Because in GR, it will be connected to a condition on the matter that is responsible for that Ricci tensor. Okay. So thanks for raising that point. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's think about that that Ricci condition over here. And what I want to do now is to impose the field equations and relate it to the stress tensor. And then I'll choose a perfect fluid as a good illustration of what this all comes to in the end. So let's look at the Ricci condition. And what I'm going to do is to now impose the Einstein field equations. And I'll write the Einstein field equations in full form. So it's going to be Ricci tensor minus Ricci scalar. I'll allow myself a cosmological constant here because we're going to see that this really, you know, is bad news when it comes to the attractive nature of gravity. So I want to include it for that purpose. And I want to equate this to the stress tensor of whatever matter field is present in the space-time. And what I want to do is to solve for the Ricci tensor and then re-express everything in terms of cosmological constant and matter stress tensor. So in order to do that, all I have to do is to eliminate the trace term. So I'm going to take the trace of that equation And if I do that, well, the trace of the Ricci scalar is, Ricci tensor is Ricci scalar. Over here, I have the trace of the metric, which gives me a factor of 4. Here I have the trace of the metric again, that gives me another factor of 4. And over here I have the trace of the stress tensor, and I'm going to call that T. All right, so R minus 2R, that's minus R. And then I'm going to put everything on the right-hand side. I get minus 4 lambda plus 8 pi T. And what I'm going to do is to plug that back into the first equation, and we're going to solve for the Ricci tensor all by itself. So I'm going to put the Ricci tensor on the left-hand side and throw everything out to the right-hand side. So on the right-hand side, I'm going to have half g alpha beta times the Ricci scalar, but I now have solved for this. I'm going to kill this minus sign and write it like this. So I have 4 lambda minus 8 pi t. That's the Ricci term. I have minus lambda g alpha beta, and then I have 8 pi t alpha beta. So that's what I have for the Ricci tensor. So I'm going to clean this up. I'm going to bring the stress tensor terms together with a factor of 8 pi minus a half t g alpha beta. So that's the matter part. And then the cosmological part, I have 2 lambdas minus a lambda, so that leaves me with 1 lambda. So that's what the Ricci tensor is, according to the field equations. And the Ricci condition then, well, all I have to do is to take the UU component of this. So with the 8 pi, that's going to give me the UU component of the stress tensor. And then I have minus half t that multiplies g multiplying u multiplying u. So that's a nice minus 1. And then I have lambda that again multiplies g that multiplies u. So that's another minus 1. So the Ricci condition in the end, so I'll write it back over here. The Ricci condition after using the field equations amounts to 8 pi t alpha beta u alpha u beta plus half t, and then minus lambda. So that's the thing that is supposed to be positive. And we see that, well, perhaps we'll manage the matter term to turn out to be positive. That's going to be fairly easy to achieve, although there's going to be some, you know, some ways of making it negative. But, you know, the bad news with the cosmological constant is that it necessarily comes with a negative sign. So if the constant is positive, which is the sign that it seems to have in our own universe, what it tends to do is to make things, you know, accelerate apart. So that's why the acceleration of the universe now seems to be, you know, positive. And basically it tells us that even though we would like to make a statement about gravity being attractive, while in fact the cosmological constant is producing a defocusing of our geodesics, that's what the acceleration of the universe is all about. And that means that gravity, in fact, with a cosmological constant is not attractive. It's actually repulsive. So, of course, it's a matter of competition between those two terms. If this is positive, maybe it overcomes the negative cosmological constant. But for the universe, according to measurements today, that's not the case. The matter part is subdominant regarding, you know, relative to the cosmological constant part. And we do measure an expansion of the universe that's actually accelerated. So, when we're talking, so that's back to the point that I was making before, that for the time-like, you know, the focusing theorem regarding time-like geodesics, it's not as satisfying as we could hope because of the fact that, well, the Ricci condition seems a little bit problematic, and the condition of hypersurface orthogonality seems to be a little bit strong. So it doesn't really give us what we want. In the null case, it's going to be far more forgiving. and we're going to see that we can get a far more, stronger, a far stronger version of the theorem if we, specialize it to null geodesics instead. Then we'll get there. We'll get there at some point. Okay, so let me work through this a little bit more just to get this in more concrete terms. Here I'll assume that our stress tensor is actually coming from a perfect fluid. Then we're going to be able to write this in terms of the fluid density and the fluid pressure, so that I think it's going to turn that into something a bit more concrete. So far, so good with the calculations? Okay. So let's specialize this further to a perfect fluid. So perfect fluid, I can always write the stress tensor in terms of a density. So that would be the co-moving energy density of the fluid. And here I'll take the fluid velocity to be distinct from the velocity of the congruence, although I could choose them to be the same. And we're going to do that when I look at an example of this for cosmology. But now I'll take the fluid velocity to be distinct. And then it's characterized also by pressure. And the pressure part of the stress tensor comes with the projection operator that takes us in the space orthogonal to the velocity field. So if we use this, then the UU component of this is going to be mu times the scalar product between V and U all squared. So I'll write it like that. And then we have P. And that comes with the scalar product of U by itself. So that gives us a minus 1. Plus, again, the scalar product between V and U twice. So I can write it like this. And let's see, I think I'll probably leave it at that for now. And then if I want to calculate the trace of the stress tensor, the trace of the stress tensor, well, I just take the trace here. So it's going to be mu times minus 1 plus P times 4 minus 1. So that's 3. So the trace of the stress tensor is minus mu plus 3P. So if I put that combination together that we have over here, this T alpha beta, U alpha U beta, plus a half T, well, that becomes, mu. So I'm going to combine all the mu terms and all the P terms together. So it becomes mu V dot U squared minus 1. Right? And then I have P that comes with a minus 1 plus V times U. And then I have those 3, minus 1 plus 3 over here. Sorry, I'm doubting myself for a second. Oh, no, that's fine. No. Oh, I forgot the 1/2. You're supposed to tell me these things. Forgot the 1/2. So it was plus 1/2 of t, so this should have been minus 1/2, and this should have been plus, plus 3/2. Over here. Okay, so I think that's going to work out better this way. Okay. I think it's more complicated than I wanted it to be, so I think I'm going to pick U to coincide with V. I think that's going to be simpler to interpret. Otherwise, I will have to, do a bit more in terms of... So let me just do that. So I'm going to choose V alpha to be the same as U alpha, so I'm really talking about I'm really talking about a congruence that's attached to that fluid. I think it's going to simplify simplify the expressions, and it means that the scalar product between u and v is actually going to be minus 1. So when I make those choices here, I'm going to have 1 minus 1/2, so it's going to be 1/2 mu. And over here, I'm going to get minus 1/2 plus 1, sorry, minus 1 plus 1, that's 0, plus 3/2 mu, p, sorry. So yeah, so that's what I wanted to have. I want to have an overall factor of 1/2 plus a neat expression involving the fluid density and the fluid pressure. Okay, so sorry, I should have done that from the start. I thought I would get something a little bit neater than I did for that calculation. Okay, so with all this, we can look back at that term over here. And what we see is that on the right-hand side, so if I rewrite the Ricci condition, what I get is, well, the first term over here is what I just wrote down before. So I kill the 1/2 with the 8 pi, so I get 4 pi mu plus 3p. And then I get the offending term, so that comes from matter, and I get the offending term minus lambda. So that's what the Ricci condition becomes. And if we didn't have a cosmological constant, I think it would be reasonable to assume that the density of matter is positive and that it comes with positive pressure, at least that it doesn't come with negative pressure that would overcome the positivity of the density. So it would be very reasonable to expect that this would be positive or zero unless the matter goes away altogether. But of course, we get that, and that we cannot impose to be positive unless the cosmological constant is negative. So, you know, there's a lot of work that's been devoted to physics in anti-de Sitter space where the cosmological constant is negative. But as far as I'm concerned, that's not our universe. Our universe comes with a positive constant, and therefore with a positive term. So to insist that this should be positive always is a bit tricky. And in fact, under the physical conditions of the universe, it's not satisfied. So for our own universe, for the cosmological fluid that follows the expansion of the universe, it's actually violated. But for other conditions where, for example, we might be talking about the matter of a star, the matter of a collapsing star that's eventually going to form a black hole, well, we're certainly dealing with conditions where the densities and pressures are far larger than the cosmological scale. And for those situations, we can certainly guarantee that the right-hand side is zero, let's say for a star, whether it's collapsing or not. So the bottom line is that when we have, you know, classical matter that behaves properly, namely with positive density, positive pressure, we do have, and you know, classical matter that with densities that way, dominate the cosmological constant, and that's the conditions pretty much everywhere in the universe except for the whole universe itself. So for anything that has to do with a neutron star or a star or, you know, anything that contains, you know, large amounts of matter, the right-hand side, sure, is easily zero. But for the universe as a whole, it's actually negative. So for the universe as a whole, we cannot take gravity to be attractive. In fact, we know it to be repulsive. That's why we have the acceleration of the universe. But for other contexts, like gravitational collapse, well, that seems to be just fine. Although, you know, there's something a bit weak about this conclusion here, because while here I took my stress tensor to be coming from a perfect fluid, but there are other types of matter that you can, you know, think about, like scalar fields or, you know, more exotic things that easily produce violations of that condition. So that's, you know, always of an issue when you invoke the Ricci condition. It's also known as the strong energy condition, that you can think of many situations where it's going to be satisfied, but you can also think of situations where it's violated. And that means that the theorem is basically built on those shaky building blocks, and you can violate the theorem by violating the premises if you come up with, you know, matter fields that are sufficiently exotic. And, you know, one example being the cosmological constant.
Can we get a sense as to how exotic the matter field has to be in order to violate this condition?
I don't think it has to be that exotic. I think if you just write down a massive scalar field and you work out the Ricci condition for that or the strong energy condition for that, I think you'll find it to be violated pretty generically. So, of course, you may not believe that scalar fields are manifested in nature, but what do we know, right? I mean, they might be present. I don't know about the Axion field, whether that's violating any conditions like this. Does anyone know?
But you said that the this being the strong energy condition,
right?
The null energy condition is going to be a little more forgiving.
Yes, the null energy condition is only a statement about the density instead of a relationship between density and pressure. And it's harder to come up with classical matter that would have negative energy density. Quantum matter, that's another situation. So if you allow quantum fields to be the source of a stress tensor, then it's easier to find, you know, very, very small violations of the energy conditions. You can come up with quantum states that give you at least in localized regions, give you energy density for your quantum field. But then, you know, that tends to be a rather small effect. If you overwhelm the quantum matter with classical matter, then it's game over and you don't have that. But yeah, it's always a source of, you know, debate and, you know, a bit of, you know, it's a bit uncomfortable to have to rely on the strong energy condition when the strong energy condition is not that hard to be violated. So that's why I think the time-like case for the focusing theorem is a bit weak. And when we come back to the null case at some point, I think we'll see that some of those weaknesses are going to be, you know, removed.
So can we be a little bit more precise in our language? Like we're saying, oh, this is how gravity can be attractive or repulsive, but in reality it's more like attractive or repulsive specifically for time-like geodesics.
Right, but that's how you make things operational, right? So how would you make operational the notion that gravity attracts? Well, I think that's where you have to introduce observers. You have to introduce, you know, an observer relative to another observer. So that's where those congruences come in, and they help you make all of this operational.
Right, but how do I like think of the difference between gravity being attractive for time-like geodesics versus null geodesics? Like, those two seem to be completely different.
excuse me, losing my voice. I think that's true. So I think, as far as I'm aware, that's how precise it gets. But it's certainly true that if you're thinking, so time-like geodesics are relevant because that's what observers would be, right? So they, you know, you can think of observers as moving on geodesics, and they have to be time-like. Null geodesics, well, they're relevant for other things, but they're not relevant for description of observers. So in that sense, it's stronger, but of course less helpful in the goal to make things operational. So I think that's the best we can do here. At least I haven't done anything better than this. Yep.
And these energy conditions always I have hard time understanding it. So let me start from a historical point of view. People came up first with this energy condition, or they came up with the fact that, okay, I want gravity to be attractive, and I need the focusing theorem to be true.
Right.
Based on the condition there. And if I want the Einstein equation to be true, then I have this condition on the matter.
Right.
Was this the first step, or they had that energy with those energy conditions in mind, and they say, okay, in nature, this is and now see if that is true, then gravity is also attractive, if you forget about lambda.
Right. Yeah. And in fact, when all of this was developed in the 70s, lambda was gone from, you know, from consideration, and it was forced back on us back in the 90s. No, I think it's the first option. So people, you know, in the 70s started to want to formulate very powerful theorems, and you know, part of that was, you know, to describe the physics of black holes, singularity theorems, and things like that. And then they noticed that in order to prove something, that they had to impose conditions, and those conditions on the Ricci tensor became important. And then through the field equations, they were turned into energy conditions. But I don't think people were talking about energy conditions before the need to prove theorems that required them.
They're not very solid, I mean, and separate things, right?
No, no.
Just be like matters behave.
Yeah, and I mean, and then you can examine all the types of classical matter you might consider, and you find that, well, the energy conditions are satisfied. So matter tends to want to satisfy those conditions. So, but you know, give theorists a chance, and they will find exotic scenarios where anything you want might be violated. And that's where people started to think of, you know, exotic fields, Axe-Keeler fields, and things like that, where you could find violations. And then it sort of became understood that, yeah, probably it's satisfied for all types of matter that we might care about if we want to describe stars and things collapsing to black holes, but it doesn't mean that it's satisfied by everything. You can't rule out, I mean, you can't rule out that the universe is going to be stranger than you thought, and that there might be those strange matter fields present. And these days, you know, the idea that black holes might be surrounded by axion clouds is, you know, is a popular idea. I'm not sure if it's going to be, you know, realized or, you know, verified in nature, but, you know, it's an attractive idea. And I don't know if the axion cloud violates or satisfies the energy conditions, but that's something that we could find out. Yeah, so that's the idea. So the energy conditions at first seem very well motivated and verified by most all forms of classical matter, and then gradually it, you know, it occurred to people that you know, it was not so hard to produce violations if you look hard enough. Okay, other questions about this? Okay, so let me just work through a very quick example that recycles what we did before. So let's see how this applies to an expanding universe, because, you know, that seems to be a very relevant application of this. And then I'll talk about how we can use Ray Chowdhury's equation to, you know, get some really powerful insights about space-times. That's where, you know, the claim that it's a very insightful equation, and maybe the most insightful equation, I think will come out more clearly. So let's just do an example involving a cosmological flow. So we worked through this before, so I won't have to do much work here. So we're talking about a spatially flat cosmological model with a scale factor a squared of t that multiplies the spatial line element for a flat section of the universe. So the sections flat, the spatial sections of the universe are flat like this, and the only thing that happens is that as the universe evolves, those spatial slices, in a sense, are growing larger. So we've talked about this. If I define some volume in that spatial slice at some instant of time, and I see what happens to it later on, each, you know, the boundary of that region, or the region itself being defined by the cosmological flow, then what we find is that, well, the volume at one time is related to the volume at some other time by that equation. Right? Theta is going to be the fractional change of the volume as the universe expands. So that's a very concrete illustration of what we're talking about. And we calculated theta for this, and if I remember correctly, that happened to be equal to 3 times the Hubble parameter, which is a dot, or the, you know, the Hubble function, which is a dot over a. And again, so that's something we can write as 1 over a cubed times the time derivative of a cubed. And again, that tells us that this is measuring the fractional rate of volume change. So what does Ray Chowdhury's equation telling us about this quantity? Well, we can just apply, apply the equation to it. So in that case, we're dealing with a congruence such that the shear tensor is zero. So we can kill the middle term over here. The Ricci term, we just worked it out. It's right here. That's going to be the same, in this example. So the only thing we have to do is to take that derivative and add this term over here. So d theta d tau, well, it's just going to be that derivative over here. So it's going to be 3 a dot dot over a minus a dot squared over a squared. So that's what we have on the left-hand side. So what we have then for the equation is that 3 a dot dot over a minus 3 a dot squared over a squared, that's going to be equal to minus a third theta squared, which gives us 9 a dot squared over a squared. And then we have minus the Ricci term, which is minus 4 pi mu plus 3 p plus lambda. So we have a nice cancellation between this and that. And what we have, therefore, is a statement about the acceleration of the universe being made equal to the matter contribution, which comes with a negative sign. So that would produce a decelerating universe if that's all we had. But again, the nasty cosmological constant coming with a, this time the opposite sign, the positive sign. And that tells us that the cosmological constant, if it dominates, will produce a positive acceleration for the universe. So the situation today, according to measurements, is that this is larger than this. And at the current era, the universe is accelerating. Back in the early history of the universe, the matter was, compressed. If you go back, in time in the universe, the volume of the universe was much smaller. The matter was very compressed. The densities were very high. So that was strongly dominated in the early universe. The cosmological constant almost plays no role in the early universe. But there comes a time, and that's what's called a little bit, sometimes the cosmic coincidence, that, shortly in our recent past of the universe, that started to dominate over this, and we started to go from a decelerating phase to an accelerating phase of the universe. And if we wait long enough, well, eventually the densities will dilute away to almost nothing, and it's going to be almost non-existent on the right-hand side, and the evolution of the universe is going to be entirely dominated by the cosmological constant, and it's going to be an exponential acceleration, for the rest of the history of the universe. So for the infinite future, lambda, unless something changes in our understanding of the universe, the prediction now is that lambda will eventually dominate over everything, and we'll all be living in the de Sitter universe with matter completely unimportant in terms of the dynamics of the universe. So this is, again, the statement that matter tends to focus, but the cosmological constant does the opposite, defocuses. And that's the statement, again, that matter, ordinary matter that satisfies the energy condition, tends to produce attractive gravity. Cosmological constant does the opposite. And that's why we're dealing these days with an accelerated universe. So all of that is revealed to us by Ray Chowdhury's equation. It also happens to be one of the Friedmann equations. So you could get that directly from from the Einstein-Field equations, because after all, we are talking about, a specific component to the field equations. But this is a component that happens to have, provide to us all this insight about how things behave. So without even solving the field equations, we have all of this insight about what's happening in the universe in terms of the qualitative behavior of, in this case, the cosmological flow. So that's where you know, we see the insight that the equation provides to us, because while here I did use a specific metric to come up to conclusions about the acceleration of the universe, but I never really had to solve the field equations. I used the field equations to relate the Ricci tensor to the matter, but I never had to integrate the field equations to get this qualitative idea of what the flow is going to be. I know without doing any work really, the Reich-Schauder equation tells me specifically that if this wins over that, we're going to get a decelerating universe. Otherwise we're going to get the opposite, namely an accelerated universe. Then I have to find the exact solution for A that describes this. The differential equation is good enough. And all of this is basically provided to us free of charge from Reich-Schauder's equation. So that's where the power of insight that it brings us, I think, is made pretty clear. And I'm going to give you a second example in a moment. Yep.
So you said that that is one of the Friedmann equations. And as far as I understand, you can derive the Friedmann equations from the Einstein equations.
Yep.
So, but we did this without invoking the Einstein equations. It's just a property of differential geometry.
No, so the Einstein equations have lurked in there because we've related the Ricci tensor to the stress tensor, so that's why we have density and pressure appearing here. So they were involved.
Right, but we still used a property that wasn't Einstein's equation. We plugged it into a property that wasn't Einstein's equations, right?
It depends how you choose to interpret this, because as soon as I see this in an equation, I pretty much know that in disguise I'm dealing with one component of the Einstein field equations, namely the UU component.
Yeah.
So what I've done essentially is to rewrite one of the Einstein field equations in a form that brings us all of this information. The point to be made is that this is not necessarily distinct from the field equations, but all of the insight that it gives us is provided without having to integrate the field equations. We don't have to find a solution. It's good enough to stare at the differential equation in this case and know what's going to happen in terms of, the flow of the whole universe. So we don't need to know what A as a function of T is. We could solve the equation and figure it out. But the point is that, the differential equation tells us qualitatively what's going to happen without all of this detailed work. So that's where the insight comes from. Other questions about this? All right, here's a second example, which I think is, really cute. Let's think about a wormhole spacetime. So wormholes are very exotic. They, very likely, I would be putting a lot of money on this bet, they don't exist in nature. But people have enjoyed, talking about them, working with them, involving them in movies, and doing all sorts of calculations with them, including putting them in binary orbits and trying to see what kind of gravitational waves they would produce. I mean, I could insert an editorial comment here, but I don't think I have to. But it's a fun thing to look at, and you know what they are, right? It's a shortcut through the universe that allows you to travel long distances through a hole in space-time. So one way of describing them would be to say, okay, we have two faraway regions that I'm, describing as being essentially flat. So I have one over here, another one down here. And then what I'm going to do is to plug a hole here and dig a tunnel from one region to the next. And the idea is that if I wanted to travel from here to here, using the traditional path, I would have to go a very long distance, or I can just go through the wormhole and a trip that would take me light years can be done in 10 minutes. So that's the idea of the wormhole. And, it's a lot of fun to think about these things. Now, what we could do and understand, what might be required to get a wormhole in general relativity would be to say, okay, let's write down a metric that describes this. And I don't remember if I've assigned that problem for the second homework, but you know, there's a problem in the book where we do that. And then, you know, from that metric, we could calculate the Einstein tensor. From the Einstein tensor, we could get the stress tensor. And we could look at all the ways that energy conditions are violated for that space-time. And that would be a very detailed exercise that relies on some form of solution that would describe this wormhole. But with Ray Chowdhury's equation, we don't have to do anything like this to conclude that there must be exotic matter that violates the energy conditions in this case. It comes straight out of the cartoon. And here's the reasoning. So suppose that you and I are traveling down the wormhole. So I'm going first, and I'm going to follow this time-like world line that takes me right through to the other side. And suppose that, well, you follow me on this trip, and you're going to be, you know, traveling close to me, and you're going to travel like this on a neighboring time-like geodesic. Well, look at here. We're coming together toward the wormhole, so our, you know, congruence of time-like geodesics is converging. Here, as we go through the throat, it converges again. It diverges again. So start converging, and then as we travel through the wormhole, it comes out to the other side, and now we're diverging again. So here we're violating the focusing theorem. So what used to be a converging congruence becomes an expanding congruence. That means that theta had to change sign along the way. That means that the acceleration is not going to be negative. How can we achieve this? We can't achieve this with this and this and that. We have to achieve it through the Ricci term. And the only way to achieve this is to make sure that the Ricci term comes with the wrong sign, so that we don't have a focusing theorem for that spacetime. So for in a situation like this, the cartoon tells me that in this case, we are violating the Ricci condition. That's how we can get a converging congruence turning into a diverging congruence. And without doing any calculation, I know completely, you know, without a doubt, that this Ricci condition has to be violated. And if I reinterpret this in terms of stress tensor, contribution, I know that this combination of things here has to be non-negative. So if I forget about the cosmological constant in this case, if the whole thing is negative in this case, then it's got to be that the sum of mu plus 3p for the matter that lives inside a wormhole, that has to be negative, and I have to violate the energy conditions in a rather, you know, spectacular way. And in fact, if you did the first version of the exercise where you start with a metric and look at all the components of the stress tensor that the metric gives you, then you would find that, I think that's the conclusion, but you'll have to work it through, that all, all those things, you know, the density and the pressure have to be negative so that everything is violated. All the energy conditions are violated somewhere inside the throat. So that's where I find the Ray Chowdhury equation most, you know, insightful, because without doing calculations, just by drawing cartoons like this, you can come to a very clear conclusion about the nature of matter that produces a space-time like this. And that can be done at the level of, you know, embedding diagrams like this, but sometimes it can be done at the level of drawing causal diagrams, describing, you know, the causal property of the space-time. You can draw a picture, but then you can see that the picture doesn't work because, you know, converging congruences would have to turn into diverging ones according to the cartoon. And that tells you right away that, well, there's something strange going on in terms of the focusing theorem. So that's the beauty of the equation, is that, you know, it helps you acquire deep insights about a space-time without having to do any calculation and without even having an explicit metric to work with. This, you know, doesn't care about the detailed nature of the wormhole, and, you know, it doesn't have to be spherically symmetric. It doesn't have to do anything like this. If you see a converging congruence turning into a diverging one, you know from Ray Chowdhury that the energy condition or the Ricci condition had to be violated. And that is pretty amazing when you think about it. You get a lot of information for very little cost, and you know that cost has been paid once and for all already. Yep.
So I just go back to our initial assumption that the flow has to be hypersurface orthogonal.
Right.
So, I mean, say I don't have a flow that's either service or orthogonal, and I want to implicitly interpret that as some sort of spin in the space-time, but I'm not going to go that far because I think
no, that's a bit deceiving because it's really the local the local rotation of fluid elements as opposed to an overall rotation. So it could be positive in one direction, negative in others, so that there's no overall rotation. But anyway, that's besides the point.
Yeah. So if we relax this assumption, can I have an understanding as to what extra degrees of freedom I have to violate the focusing theorem?
No, and that raises that point again, and it's a good point that, you know, all of this rests on that assumption, which is a pretty, you know, severe restriction on the kind of congruences we're considering here. And you're right. So what if we can't realize a congruence that satisfies this? Then we wouldn't be able to conclude anything. So that's a limitation. Again, I'll say it again. So when we consider the null version of this, we're going to see that that condition is far more reasonable, and you know, we can implement it. So there's a protocol where you can implement it, and therefore in that null case, that is far less restrictive than in the time-like case. And then the thought would be, well, instead of talking about observers, let's talk about null rays going through a wormhole. And if the geometry is like this, then all rays will converge and then diverge. And that's going to be, again, a clear violation of the null energy condition in that case. So that's where it's helpful to... So the null version of this can be even more insightful because of the, you know, severity of this in the time-like case. Yep, Berendt.
So... if I remember correctly, in the null case, you can always find around a point a hypersurface orthogonal congruence. So in the time case, it's sometimes impossible to find such a flow.
So that's a good question. I don't know how to answer this, whether it's always possible to find one versus there being spacetimes where it's impossible to find one. So that I don't know. So I would have thought that it's a bit restrictive to have a geodesic congruence. So I don't think you could get, I don't know. So that's a point that I don't know how to answer, whether you can always find a geodesic congruence that's hypersurface orthogonal under any circumstances. That sounds difficult to achieve to me, but I could be wrong about this.
Okay.
And
so you say this is an easy condition to impose if we're talking about null geodesics.
Right.
So is there a sense in which I can have like a wormhole that works in the sense that it just satisfies this, you know, focusing and defocusing thing, if for non-hypersurface orthogonal flow of time-bound geodesics versus not working for null geodesics, because I can always find a hypersurface orthogonal flow.
I suppose it's possible where you could, you know, come up with some wormhole solution, and probably people have done, where you don't violate the strong energy condition, how do you want it? You don't violate the strong energy condition,
right.
But you...
you necessarily have to violate the null energy.
Right. No, I don't think you could. I don't know, but I think it would have to be a rather complicated space-time, because for all the simple examples where you impose spherically symmetric, then hypersurface orthogonality is guaranteed. If the congruence is spherically symmetric, it's going to be hypersurface orthogonal, and then you don't lose anything. So you would have to come up with a rather complicated space-time where you could have one but not the other. But yeah, people have played a lot with wormholes. I think a lot of things have been, you know, tried and tested.
Warp drive.
Well, that's another, yeah. Warp drive is another example where you have to violate an energy condition by the very feature that you're trying to produce. Yep.
So what the before they pass through the wormhole, the energy condition is not being violated.
Right.
And who's measuring that? That we assume that it's measured by themselves, those guys that they are passing through. And we said U and B.
Those would be the co-moving density, co-moving pressure, so they would be, yeah.
So what if someone is in the top universe there, that measure, everything is okay, and then they don't see from the moment that they pass through the wall somehow.
If you don't have access to all the measurements, you can't conclude much, and you know, you can come up with wormhole solutions where all the matter is concentrated at one spot over here. So you would not violate anything here, not here, but you know, at the moment of crossing, everything would get. So I mean, that's fine. So you can certainly introduce violations of energy conditions that are localized in spots, and the rest of the universe is going about its business perfectly happy. But you know, if you happen to encounter that region, then something strange happens.
What about those people who are the other side of the universe? They are seeing some defocusing, right?
Well, they don't see. So all the defocusing happens in the throat. After that, they might be flying apart, but they're no longer defocused, right? So you can fly apart and still be decelerated, and that's what would happen here. Here they're coming together, being accelerated. Here they're flying apart, being decelerated. So, you know, the behavior here is perfectly fine, here is perfectly fine, but something in between had to happen to turn one into the other.
So it is a reasonable solution to that, instead of talking about singularities, we say that
right.
Something weird happens there. See it.
Yeah, I mean, people have talked about, you know, a solution to the black hole information paradox in terms of having lots of tiny wormholes being produced close to the singularity of the black hole. And the idea is that all of the stuff that falls in would eventually escape through those wormholes. And yes, you do have to violate the energy conditions, but presumably in a region of space-time that's really close to the singularity, where presumably quantum gravity effects become dominant, and maybe quantum gravity allows you to violate whatever you want. So it's not completely crazy that this might be a resolution, but of course we'll never know, because unless we have a solid prediction of quantum gravity that this is happening, we'll never be able to find out unless you take the trip. Right?
Yeah. This reminds me a lot about a discussion in your book when you were talking about Kerr black holes.
Mm-hmm.
About going down the axis of symmetry and through the ring singularity and then out the other side.
Right. Yeah. So if you follow the exact solution, either for Reissner-Nordström or the Kerr black hole, and if you assume that that solution extends all the way through the black hole, then yeah, you'll come out on the other side. So you'll come out through you'll go through the black hole, you'll come out through a white hole into a distinct universe in your future. But that's taking the exact solutions a little bit farther than they intend to be. So, I mean, we'll talk more about this when the time comes.
The singularity of the black hole is like this in that it doesn't satisfy the energy conditions.
In that Reissner-Nordström or Kerr case, so those effects don't really have to do with the singularity as such. And if you're in vacuum, of course, you're not violating any conditions. I think there's a different mechanism at play there that I'm not seeing right now.
I think the hypersurface orthogonality thing might not hold in that case.
So for Kerr, it would be an issue. For Reissner-Nordström, it may not be because it's spherically symmetric. But I'd have to think about what evades the focusing theorem in that case. I don't remember. Yeah, but we don't care about that here, right? So that's an argument in favor of not extending the solution beyond the Cauchy horizon. So that, I think, is pretty good. But if we insisted on staying in the exact Kerr background and allowed ourselves to escape through the other universe, we would be talking about converging congruences being turned into diverging ones, and I'm not sure what's broken here.
Right.
So I should know this because I've done work on that stuff, but I'm not remembering at this point.
But do you have a long
sequence that starts out as being focusing and then defocusing. I don't think just because you have a curve that extends to another universe doesn't necessarily mean that.
Maybe there's a subtlety there that I'm not seeing.
Because this seems robust.
It's hard to see where it could go wrong. But yeah, I have to think about this, and I'd rather not do it in real time. I'll get it wrong.
Interesting to discuss nonetheless.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And as always, I enjoy those discussions when they arise. Okay, so I have maybe 10 minutes left. So let me set up the next step. So that's done. We're done with timeline congruences. And the main message today was the focusing theorem and how it can, gives us great insights into space-times without having to do any work. So I consider that to be a really remarkable achievement. And, that's just scratching the surface of all of this. I mean, all of this is involved in all the theorems on black holes that Penrose and Hawking and others formulated, singularity theorems. I mean, it's really, really central in all of this. So very important stuff. There's really a ton of insightful information that comes out of all of this. But now I want to turn to the null case, because I did promise that the null case was a bit more robust, less subjected to, arbitrary assumptions like hypersurface orthogonality and all of this. And I want to go into this. And it's going to give me an opportunity to really tell you what null geodesics are. Because it turns out to be a bit more subtle than typically is talked about in textbooks. And I think it's a good opportunity to really think about what they are and how they're physically realized, because it's not as obvious as it may seem. So that's where we're going. So we're launching into a discussion of null geodesics, and eventually we'll talk about congruences, and we'll talk about all of this decomposition of the velocity gradient. We'll reintroduce the expansion, shear, rotation tensor. We'll reintroduce all of those things in the case of null geodesics and eventually formulate Ricci-Auduri's equation for null congruences, and then, talk about a focusing theorem in this case. But before we do all of this, I really want to take the time to talk about null geodesics and how they're physically realized, because I think that's very important and often sort of not discussed very much. Okay, so we're starting a new section, section 3. And now we're talking about congruences of null geodesics. And the first question is, and I'm just going to set this up and then we'll go a bit more into it in the afternoon. Well, what's a null geodesic? And part of that question is, well, how do we define it physically? I know how to define it mathematically, but how do we define it physically? How do we realize it as a physical idea? And we all know the answer to this. The null geodesics are going to be the path of photons or the path of null rays. But what's a photon and what's a null ray? So that's where I want to go a bit deeper, because it sounds good to say these words, but I don't think everybody necessarily understands what the words convey in terms of the underlying physics. So that's why I want to spend the time, and I'll spend quite a bit of time. So you'll have to bear with me here, because I'll go, fairly deep into, I think, a very solid discussion of how null geodesics arise, in physics. So what's a null geodesics? Well, we could say that it's the path of a photon. But if I say this, you'll have to tell me what a photon is. And then I could tell you something slightly different that conveys the same sense. It's the path of a light ray. But if you give me that answer, or if I give you that answer, I'll have to tell you what a light ray is. So that's the idea. So what's a photon? Well, okay. You know, the way I know how to describe photons in physics is to start with quantum field theory. So I have QED. And a photon typically in QED is a momentum eigenstate of the electromagnetic field. And if it's a momentum eigenstate, that means that, well, it's perfectly localized in momentum space, but completely delocalized in physical space. So the good old uncertainty relation of Heisenberg. And presumably that's not what I mean here, because if I'm talking about some kind of quantum state that's completely delocalized, I can't talk of its motion, right? So maybe I know the momentum, but I know nothing of its position. I'm not describing what I'm thinking I'm describing here. Okay, so maybe it's not a momentum eigenstate, maybe it's a position eigenstate. So now I know the position with full certainty, but that means I know nothing about the momentum, so I don't know if it's going to go this way or that way. So presumably that's not what we're talking about here. And by the way, I've never seen, you know, a photon being described in terms of quantum field theory in curved space-time. It could be done. I mean, you know, I've seen it described in quantum field theory in curved space-time, but not in the context of explaining what null geodesics are. So that's not what we mean. So that's not going to be quite this, although we all use that phrase, and I've used it many times, and, you know, it's not terribly wrong. It's just that it's not terribly precise, and it doesn't really tell us much about exactly what's underlying null geodesics. Okay, so maybe we can do better if we say path of a light ray, because here we're talking about non-quantum things, so we're not bothered with the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So maybe we can forget about photons, but really adopt the more classical language and say we're describing the path of a light ray. But now I would have to describe what the light ray is. And presumably that means, you know, talking about the electromagnetic field, but not all configurations of electromagnetic fields correspond to, you know, light rays propagating. So we would have to find the right kind of configurations to the electric field and magnetic field that describes, you know, light rays maybe propagating through a medium or something like that. So that's what I'm talking about. So there's a lot behind those phrases that is typically not discussed, but presumably are important if we're going to be using this language. We really want to know what a light ray is in physics terms and see how it emerges that a light ray travels on a null geodesic. And of course, it has to do with light traveling at the speed of light. No big surprise here, but we still have to, you know, say something about what's the physical description of a light ray, you know, in a curved space-time. And that's where we'll, you know, that's where we'll go. So we'll talk about configurations of electromagnetic field that has the right, you know, flavor to describe light and, you know, a beam of light that would be traveling in some space-time. And my point here is that those ideas are, you know, not difficult, but they require a treatment. And I think that treatment is really underpinning in a very solid, you know, precise way what we mean by all of this. And after that's been understood, I think that's fine. You can go back to the loose and popular language that everybody uses it, but that everybody uses. But I think it's good to take the time at least once to think more deeply about what this all means. And I'll leave it for that now because we run out of time, but I'll even say that there are issues like this without even thinking of curved space-time. So, you know, what if I want to precisely define in physical terms what a light beam is in, you know, conventional optics? You know, we could have some kind of light beam that travels through some kind of refractive medium. And how do we describe this in terms of configurations of electric field, magnetic field? Well, there's an answer to that. And, you know, it can be all worked out, and we will work it out. But the point is that there's something to be said about what a light beam is. It's not just something that's given to us a priori. It's something that corresponds to a very specific type of electromagnetic field. And, you know, it's going to be up to us here to say more about what type. So what am I talking about here when I'm talking about specific configurations of electromagnetic field. And the point being that I can think of many configurations of electric field or magnetic field that have no notion of anything traveling with the speed of light. I can have a static field, doesn't have any traveling attributes, but and that doesn't do it, right? So I have to introduce very specific types of solutions to Maxwell's equations in order to describe something that I might call a light ray or a light beam or something like that. And that's the idea. Once we understand what goes, you know, inside of this, we can come up with a derivation of what null geodesics are and how they're realized in physics. So it's going to take us a little while to do this, but I think it's worthwhile, and I think you're going to learn from that. And you're going to understand why this is a little bit of a shortcut answer that doesn't really do it for, shouldn't do it for anybody, except as a shorthand for, you know, all of this discussion we're going to have. Okay, so we're going to start about this. We're going to start on that this afternoon in a second lecture. So any questions before we quit? Yeah?
So I feel like we should be able to geodesic is completely geometrically.
Oh yeah, no, so that's right. So yeah, I forgot to say this, and I think that that's a very good point. I could define them mathematically, and I think I'll come back to that this afternoon because that's easy to do. I can certainly define what they are mathematically. What I'm looking after here is a physical realization of these things, and that's where it gets a little bit subtle.
So I guess the other thing I don't like about this is it seems like we necessarily want a non-zero. We're saying there's an electromagnetic field. So can we say, okay, this is the path of like a test light ray or something? Yeah.
Oh, sure. I mean, so the argument I'm going to take is that if I want to define light rays physically, I do need an electromagnetic field. It will, of course, come with a stress tensor. But that stress tensor could be insignificant in view of the curvature of the universe. So it could still be a test matter field. Okay. Yeah. So there's no issue there. Okay, good. So let's pick this up again this afternoon.